So, I shouted at a cyclist the other day. I'm trying to give it up, but sometimes it just comes out. So I was at the Oval Tube station. I was on my bike waiting at the light, and the cyclist just went through, weaving in and out of some quite elderly pedestrians, and basically gained 2 seconds on his journey. I shouted, "Do you not have any respect for pedestrians?" And I hope you share my moral outrage and my subsequent internal character assassination of this guy who just clearly had nothing good about him. Some people just do not think about anyone but themselves. The next day, as I went on my way to work and I cycled through a red light, I had a very different internal conversation. So it was fine. In my case, I'm sure you agree with me, it was fine because I was going down a small cycle path. There were no pedestrians around. I couldn't have done any damage to anyone. So I was right again. Hooray. So this reasonably small example illustrates how we can often assume the worst of others whilst we justify our own actions. And it's scientifically proven, actually, I got this from Ali, who's a psychologist, that when we do something wrong, we often blame it ourselves on external, extenuating circumstances. But when somebody else does something wrong, we assume it's due to failings in their own character. Somehow they are morally lower than we are, and therefore their wrongdoing is due to a character flaw, but ours is due to some external circumstances. Just think about the last time that maybe somebody didn't speak to you as you walked past them on the street, or even you saw them at church. If you felt ignored, you might say, well, the other person, they're rude. They're looking down on me. They just think they're above me. They've got something against me. If for some reason you maybe walked past somebody and you didn't chat to them, then obviously it's because, well, your kids are running around, or you're really busy, or you're really tired, or it wasn't the opportunity that time. So again, small behaviors of other people, even in church, we can assume are down to their own failings, but we can justify our own because there are external circumstances, extenuating circumstances that justify that. So this approach, it doesn't just make us shout at cyclists or pedestrians, but actually, at its worst, it can destroy our relationships. Our relationships with God, within our family, within our church family, with our friends, with our neighbors. And Jesus tackles this head on in the parable that we look today. He tackles it head on with the attitude that we think we're right, and therefore, whether we like it or not, whether we try or not, we can look down on others. In fact, if we look at verse 9, the opening is, "To some who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else." Ouch. But by the end of the parable, Jesus is calling for a humble heart. And he is saying that humble heart is what justifies us before God. So we'll look at that in a minute. But what I want you to take away is this today, that a humble heart is a generous heart. A humble heart is a generous heart. And we'll look a bit about what that means later on. So if you have your Bibles open, if you've got them in front of you, so Luke chapter 18, 9 to 14, I'm not quite sure what page it's on. Shout out if anyone has the page. 1052. Short parable. And remember, a parable is a story. It's a story with a meaning. We don't take everything literally, but Jesus is really pulling out a meaning from this story that would have been very familiar to his readers. And it's a story, as we see in verse 10, of two men going up to the temple to pray. This is part of what it means to be a Jew. It was very normal. Everyone related to that. It might be us, like us, coming to church. It's what you do as part of the community. And then he has a comparison in verses 11, 12 to 13. So if we put the next slide, please. I've put a little table. You might not be able to read it, but if for those of you who can, it's just a bit of a comparison between the different approaches and attitudes of the Pharisee and the tax collector. I won't go into all of it, but actually what you see is ultimately the Pharisee was really of very high standing in society. People looked up to him and probably kind of quite puffed up, quite happy with his situation. And he had come and he was approaching God saying, I am righteous. So right, I'm right before you because I am obeying the law. Because I am fasting twice a week and I'm giving a tenth of all I get. I'm tithing. Now, these things were required. They were good things to do. But the challenge with the tax collector was he was saying, because I'm doing these things, I am right and I am better than this tax collector, than the robbers, than the evildoers, and the adulterers. And it's quite interesting because Pharisees often get a really hard time in the Bible. We kind of think they are the worst of the worst. But it's quite interesting. The Pharisees, they were trying to do what was right. They had come from a time when the whole of their nation Israel had gone away from the law and they were wanting to bring them back. But that they had thought they were righteous before God. They were right before God by obeying the law, not by humbling themselves. And as a result, they were puffed up and they thought they were better than everyone else. Whereas the tax collector came, stood at a distance. He was looked down on in society. He was colluding with the Romans by taking taxes from the Jewish people. We know about Zacchaeus as probably the most famous tax collector. And he kept his distance. He beat his breast. He said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. He came with a humble heart recognizing that he needed God. And it's quite interesting because the tax collector was probably also trying to do right. We don't actually know the motives of these two people. We assume them, but we don't know. But he came with a humble heart. And at the end, Jesus says in verse 14, he went away justified. And so the key message in this passage is in verse 14. All those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. Now, humility sometimes gets a bit of a bad word in our society as well. It's like that you're a doormat, that you're really weak. But actually, ultimately, when we see in Philippians, when it says Jesus humbled himself to death on a cross, humility is about... humility is about seeing who you are before God, seeing your rightful place before God. So the tax collector saw himself as needing forgiveness, needing God's righteousness, whereas the Pharisee saw himself as kind of almost on a par with God. I've done enough, God. I'm in, aren't I? So he wasn't humble because he saw himself as puffed up. But it's interesting, we don't want the story for the tax collector or the Pharisee to end here. So the tax collector who comes and he stands at a distance, he beats his breast and says, have mercy on me as a sinner. We would hope that the tax collector, on receiving God's forgiveness, on receiving God's mercy, would actually grow in freedom and confidence of being loved by God. As Tim Keller famously said, we are more sinful than we ever dared believe, but we are more loved than we ever dared imagine. So in coming to God, as we came to God ourselves in worship with our hearts open, we would hope that the tax collector would grow in this confidence and freedom of being loved, which in turn would enable him to have a generous heart towards others. Now, we probably all oscillate a bit between the tax collector and the Pharisee in terms of how we're feeling as we approach God or as we approach our church community. But if you identify with the tax collector this morning, who stands apart, who doesn't dare approach God or join with the church family, we would love to pray with you at the end so you can really experience the confidence and joy in your salvation. Because that is the journey that this tax collector was going on. And we would know the tax collector in heaven is worshiping God, confident that he's been saved and freed to worship God, free to give to others, free to live in the joy of his salvation. Now, the Pharisee was reprimanded by Jesus, as I said, for trusting in his own actions. But a judgment by God is always with the hope of redemption. Jesus wasn't just condemning this Pharisee and then kind of casting him off. The hope for the Pharisee was that he would come to God in humility, would come recognizing that he needed God, that he was dependent on God, that he was more sinful than he dared believe, but that he would receive God's forgiveness and realize he was more loved than he dared imagine. And that in that humility, recognizing his need for forgiveness, he would then start to become generous towards others. So at the start where it said, some who are confident in their own righteousness and look down on everyone else, the invitation from Jesus to the Pharisee is that he would learn to have his confidence in God for his righteousness, and then he would not look down on everyone else because he would see that he is a sinner like everyone else, but he is loved and forgiven and therefore can be generous to when he looks upon others, not judging them and seeing them all as brothers and sisters on a journey. But also to continue in obedience to what he was doing, but this obedience as a response to his salvation. So if you identify more with the Pharisee at the moment, if you struggle feeling that you judge others for what they do, for what they think, for something they've done in the past, we would also love to pray with you at the end, or if you just be praying where you are now in your seat or with people around when we finish a little bit later on. But praying so that you can come to God in humility, be lifted up with God transforming your heart to be more generous towards others. So just, there's many, many ways that we can apply this passage, and I just want to focus on one, which is going back to thinking that a humble heart is a generous heart and what that means, what that might mean for us in practice today. And for me, the key point that I want to make, if we move through, in fact, no, we'll leave it there for the moment, is that a generous heart thinks the best of others. Now, that might sound a little bit like pop psychology, but actually, if we draw it on Jesus' words, we'll see why that is a deeply rooted call of our own discipleship. So if we go back to the start about the cyclist who went through the red light, so I started to assume in my head that the cyclist probably didn't have any morals in his tax returns, maybe he wasn't nice to his kids, maybe he was difficult to work with, all from one action. If I met him in another situation, I might think completely differently, and I've got no idea why he did what he did, whether as a one-off, whether as a habit. I only saw that snippet of his life. And it can become a vicious circle of assuming the worst of others. And this is called, which I didn't know beforehand, it's called the horn effect, which is the opposite of the halo effect. So if we can go to my beautifully designed slides. So we all know the halo effect, I think. The halo effect is often when you see one characteristic of somebody else and you assume everything else about them is great. And it's often, if somebody is attractive, then you think, well, they've got great morals, they must be creative, they must be clever, they must be good at sport, they must be generous, they must be kind, they must be a great person to hang out with. So you've seen one aspect of them, and then you think the rest is fantastic. The opposite of that is the horn effect. And it may be that you see there's one thing that somebody has disagreed with you on, or somebody has one different view, and you assume they disagree with you on everything, that if we think in church, they're on another side, they think completely differently, they're kind of just a different type of Christian. And if we think back to church, when we have a disagreement over something, we need to protect our hearts from the horn effect. Of assuming the worst of the other person, assuming negative motives, values, or belief that simply aren't there. And in recent years in our church, we know that we've disagreed badly on some major issues facing the church today. In particular, how we've dealt with racial injustice and with sexuality. We will disagree over other issues. We need to learn to disagree better. But through these disagreements, one of the main dangers is when we come to see one opinion over an issue of somebody as defining them. And that identity we give to them trumps the identity of them as our brothers and our sisters in Christ. And when we disagree with a brother or sister over a matter of theology or liturgy or anything else in the church, we need to protect ourselves from the horn effect. When we start to assume these other beliefs and motives that we see as different to our own, when we start to distance ourselves, take sides in church, that can lead to division. It's the equivalent in society of cancel culture, which is increasing. It's othering of people. It's separating ourselves. And I've had to apologize to people in this church when I've done that. And if I'm honest with you, I still think I've got some relationships that are affected by the way we have disagreed in this church. And Ali and I have been committed recently to examining our own hearts, to praying about this. And I've seen my heart change, and I've seen some of the relationships in church change over the last few weeks and months. I'm not sure how to deal with everything, but I'm committed to prayer because I don't want the devil to take a foothold in the relationships I have in church, and I don't want that to be the situation for other people. And coming to God in humility, I think he has helped to open my heart to be more generous. And as many of us are doing this series with John Mark Comer, Practicing the Way in our home groups, we looked at generosity last week. And like all spiritual disciplines, it is a habit that we need to grow in. It's not going to be a transformation overnight. It's a habit to grow in. So I'd encourage us all to press into that. So to land this in our lives now, what does a humble and a generous heart mean for us? How can we think the best of our brothers and sisters and act on it? So just a few things I've put up on the screen, but we'll go through. I think firstly, it always means examining our own hearts, humbling ourselves before God, seeing ourselves as God sees us, completely loved and completely forgiven. In verse 14, he or she who humbles themselves will be exalted. So it always starts with us. Generosity, it's a bit of heart surgery. It starts with our relationship with God, and then it moves on from there. I think it also means seeing others in the church with their primary identity as our brothers and sisters. We are a family. We may disagree as brothers and sisters, but you're a family that God has called to do amazing things here in Peckham. We all have the same Father. We've all been forgiven by Jesus dying on the cross. None of us is any better or worse than anyone else. We're all more sinful than we could ever imagine and more loved than we can ever dream of. And it also means seeing ourselves and others as on a journey of transformation towards a confidence and a joy in our salvation and a life of obedience. We may sometimes get it spectacularly wrong. We may sometimes get it spectacularly right. So let's celebrate when we do, and let's bear with each other when we don't. And it means thinking the best of others, assuming good motives. Now, that obviously doesn't apply in situations where people may have experienced abusive relationships in different, just to say that, it doesn't, but on the whole, it means we assume good motives, we are generous in what we think of others, we avoid the horn effect. And that is freeing. That brings life, that brings joy. And it means examining our own hearts as to whether we see people as on different sides of debates or in a different group in the church and repenting of this when we do. And praying for those relationships to be restored. Some may not be ready to act yet, but prayer is the first thing because our hearts need to change. And the promise is that a generous heart that thinks the best of others will bring freedom. It will bring joy. It will bring community. It will free the Spirit to move in us and through us. And that's what we're praying for.